Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 44 featuring Kevin and Snow Mac. This is another one of our series from THU, Trojan Horse was a Unicorn. I met Kevin and Snow over there. Kevin is one of my biggest heroes, and we talk about some amazing things together and how he influenced my career in a big, big way. He, as he says in a podcast, the reluctant visual effects supervisor, even though he won an Oscar for visual effects and has done some incredible VFX work, including Fight Club, Apollo 13, and a whole slew of others. Snow is also has worked in visual effects with him. She's an incredible artist as well. In fact, both of them are fine artists, and we talk about their fine art and virtual reality, which is a huge part of what Kevin is doing now. He's actually doing virtual reality fine art, and it is mind-blowing to the point where I got so interested in it, I decided that I wanted to get involved in his work and make it part of labs. So we are actually working closely with Kevin and trying to do some lab stuff with him, which is really cool. With that being said, Sean is joining us today on the podcast. Sean, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. All right, Sean, we have a couple of things we want to remind people about social media.
Yes.
Yes. Tell us what's going on in social right now.
What's going on in
social? Well, where to follow us.
Where to follow? Okay. Well, you can follow Labs.
Yes.
At sign.
Yes.
CG.
Which they call the snail sign. I think they call that the snail sign in Spain, by the way. Because it looks like a little snail.
It does. That's a very good observation.
Go ahead.
@CG_lab is for the labs.
Yep. Chaos Group itself.
For Chaos Group, it's @Chaos Group.
Yep.
And you can follow us there. And we do, we work closely.
Yeah, we work with a bunch of stuff together. More lab stuff goes on labs. And then if you're more specific to what's going on with Chaos Group and events, we have that on Chaos Group.
Yeah, we also post the current podcasts every Sunday on our Facebook, on the Chaos Group Facebook page. So you can find us on Facebook.
Yep.
We not only do we post that, but we also post a lot of very interesting videos and images and
tutorials.
Tutorial Tuesday.
Tutorial Tuesday. That's right.
Get into it.
That's really cool. And there's a lot of stuff that we can basically do on Facebook. And we're not only just Facebook and Twitter, but we're on LinkedIn. We're on Google+. We're on a bunch of stuff as well. If you're following the podcast on iTunes, make sure and rate us. That's something else we'd like you to do. So if you go up and do that, that'd be great. And a reminder, if you are listening to the podcast on, you know, iTunes or some other thing that you're subscribed to, which is great, we love subscribers, make sure to go to labs.chaosgroup.com and check out anything that we have extra material for the podcast. So I usually put like a gallery of images or things of that nature so that people, whatever we're talking about on the podcast, you can do it there. And you can also leave comments there if you have any comments to leave. So go ahead and do that. Mm-hmm. One last announcement. We are going to be at RFX in Hollywood on
November 5th.
That's right. At 7 p.m. We are going to be presenting there along with the Foundry and Thinkbox and Toon Boom and a slew of others. For our presentation, Justin Denton, our very good friend Justin, will be there to talk about some VR work that he's been doing at Legend VR. And then Zachary Cole, who's been helping us out for some V-Ray for Nuke stuff, will also be there. So he'll be talking about some V-Ray for Nuke. So hope to all see you there, and hopefully you guys enjoyed this podcast. This is a very personal podcast for me. You will notice it very quickly when you listen to it, and I hope you appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I want to tell you something that was very important. And when Andre told me that you were going to be here, I emailed him like instantly, so excited, because I couldn't wait to see you again. And here's why. Back when I was at Sony, and I was a cog in a wheel lighter. I was a good lighter. I enjoyed it.
Yes, very good lighter. The best lighter on the show.
But I sat there and I in my cubicle and I said, this is very boring. I wasn't excited, but you always made me excited and you made me say, like, I want to go into what Kevin's doing, be able to inspire people, be able to talk to people and be able to lead vision in some way. And I asked you to go to lunch with me and I took you out to lunch and you said, okay. And I said, no, usually it's hard to get time for you to do that because you're supervising a show. You usually don't have time for lunch. And you took the time to go out with me. And I told you what I did, and I said, you know, I see what happens. And you actually reinforced this. You told me the same thing. It's like, when you work in a big facility sometimes, there's steps that people expect you to take to get to that point. And it's the bigger the facility, the more steps it takes, and it'll take 15 years or, you know, 10 years sometimes to get to that point where you start here, there. And I said, I don't have time for that.
Yeah.
I don't want that. And you told me to quit my job.
I did.
You did.
Wow.
not in so many words, but you basically told me, it's like, what you probably need to do is you need to work in smaller facilities and work up the idea of how do you get relationships with people and how do you do that. And it's going to be really hard for you to start communicating with directors. But if you start working in commercials, you'll understand that skill set way quicker. And that's exactly what I did. I did it probably a few months after.
Wow.
And it changed my entire career. So where I am now, and even now after I quit, that was because of that conversation we had at lunch.
Wow.
Whoa.
So it was really important. I was really hoping that we would have some Q&A time. I know your talk went on because I really want to say that in public to you.
Oh, thank
but,
you.
But at least I had to do it on the podcast. But it was really such a wonderful thing. I appreciate that.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That means a lot to me.
It means a lot to me,
well,
too.
Well, for what it's worth, on the show, as I said, you were the best lighter, but it was clear to me that you were way more. Like, it was just like, why is this guy just doing lighting? I mean, I was so, you were like a guru to me because you wrote the book on global illumination and all this stuff. And it was your images, like I saw some of your images from the book and stuff. And
right.
It was just like, I wanted to be doing that. And we didn't have those tools yet in the facility.
No.
And I didn't have them at home.
Right.
And it was just like, I want to do physically based rendering.
Right.
And it was like, you were so already into that before anybody.
Right. Yeah, it was. And it was, that was frustrating to me too, I think. That was part mm-hmm. of the thing that I said, you know, bigger facilities, it'll take a longer time for them to adapt that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I go to a small facility, it's just, yeah, sure. Let's just use it. Let's try it, you know?
Right.
And so that allowed me to sort of do that kind of stuff. Now, to answer your previous questions, I have since left the industry, got contacted by a friend of mine. Chaos Group is makes V-Ray, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fairly large company now. I don't know if you know that. It's almost 200 people in the company.
Wow.
Their headquarters is in Bulgaria, Sofia.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Vlado and Peter started. It was two guys. Started a long time ago. And they're in Sofia. And then now they have an office in Sofia, which is their largest headquarters. And then they have an office in Baltimore that focuses a lot on the ArcViz crowd. Mm-hmm. And then we have an office in LA, which is a lot of marketing and other things that are going on there. We have an office in Tokyo, and we're having inklings of an office in Seoul as well.
Wow.
So we have all these offices. And so when they started in LA, I came in as a creative director.
Mm-hmm.
But that role seemed a little bit not quite right for me, and I naturally evolved into creating what we're calling Chaos Group Labs.
Oh, right.
So we're creating special projects, lots of cool stuff. Like what I just saw would be like a perfect labs project where we can help people. So artists come to us, people, you know, our customers come to us, and they have these ideas, and we just go for it. We give them all kinds of technology, all kinds of weird stuff. So like my friend Kevin Margo, he's doing a short, and we got in touch with NVIDIA, and NVIDIA was really supportive of it, and we gave him all these GPUs, and he's rendering everything on the GPU. So it's a GPU powered render.
Yeah, you have a GPU renderer, right?
Yeah.
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 Yeah, I've seen some of, when I was on the last movie, I was on some of the concepts artists were using it, and it was just like, what? V-Ray has a real-time render?
Yeah. And so like he's using a VCA. They have these machines that got 8 GPUs in them.
Mm-hmm.
And what's taking 3.5 hours to render on a dual processor computer
mm-hmm.
is
24 cores, let's just put it that way. On a VCA, it's rendering in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So it's just incredibly fast. So it allows him to make the time problems going away.
I've been exploring the GPU thing because that's my biggest obstacle. This took months to render, and that was with Intel's help. So,
right. You know. Well, so what were you rendering with?
Mantra.
Mantra. Okay. Yeah. All right.
And that's my, I've been drooling over V-Ray for, as long as it's been around or that I've known about it, but it's isn't it strictly Maya or?
No. When the microphones are off, I can talk to you more.
Okay.
That way. All right. Because I would love to be able to help. I would love to be able to help with all of your projects. And if I can find a way to do that, I will make it happen for you.
Awesome.
So those are some of the cool stuff I've been up to. Now, I've listened to both of your talks, and they're fabulous. They're also very different from all the other talks here, which has been great. Although they're all about art, the way that you depict and talked about art is great. And it's also extremely positive, which I think is really wonderful.
Awesome.
Yeah. Now, you both have this wonderful background that came separately and brought you guys together at Art Center. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that. So Snow, what brought you to Art Center? What was the path that brought you to Art Center?
I wanted to go to Art Center since high school. So there was a, one of those cool orange pamphlets, catalogs for Art Center.
Uh-huh.
And the way that it looked, the way it was laid out, was just so much cooler than anything else I was looking at in high school. I'm like, I want to go there.
Right.
And I applied and didn't get in right away.
Right.
So then I went to University of Maine to do a whole bunch of academic courses.
Okay.
And then I got into Maryland Institute of Art to get some more art portfolio.
Okay.
And then applied again to Art Center and got accepted. So 2 years out of high school, I come to Art Center.
And where were you from before that?
Grew up in Virginia and then moved to New Canaan in like sixth grade through high school.
Oh, okay.
So East Coast.
East Coast. Yeah. 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 My family's all kind of Northeastern.
And born in Japan and lived in Vietnam.
That's right.
During the war.
I love the story of the cheesehead in Japan, which represents your mother under the cherry blossoms.
Yeah, just a taking my cheesehead character and turning it into some personal stories.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I love the cheesehead because you were telling your story as your slideshow was going on. It's like, okay, what is up with these characters? They're
everywhere.
That
was so much fun because I had no idea how that would play out. Like, I just put the images together, wrote the talk, and then said, okay, I want music. And then bam, that, rehearsal was it.
Yeah,
that was the talk.
It just made me feel really good about art again. And I think it was really wonderful.
Well, and another story about Art Center was my mom, her sister lived in San Francisco.
Okay.
So before I started Art Center, my mom came out and she toured the school. And then she came home and she's like, you will find a nice husband there. And I was just so incensed because I was going to be a career woman. And there's just like, mom, why are you telling me that I'm going to be getting
married? What did your mom do?
My mom was a teacher.
Okay.
And she was an artist.
Uh-huh.
And, very, very beautiful drawings and then channeled that into her teaching. And then, she's like, you're going to find a great husband there.
Right.
And I just poo-pooed that. And then, of course, her prophecy came true that we met in school. And pretty much that was it.
Right.
Right, here we are 30-some years 34, later.
35 years.
35 years you've been married?
Well, we've been married 33, but we knew each other for a year or two before that.
Wow. Since 1980, so 35 years.
Now, your parents' background is also artists, am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, my mother was in ink and paint at Disney,
mm-hmm.
and my father was a background painter and a story man, and he did all kinds of stuff at Disney. He was a friend of Walt Disney's.
Oh, really?
And he was a background painter for Fantasia and Snow White and Pinocchio and just right on through, but he also did, he was one of the writers of Sleeping Beauty.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he would do, the story stuff and storyboards, and it's kind of a, did all those things.
And a bunch of shorts, too.
Yeah, he still gets residuals from all the Disney shorts.
He's passed on, but he still gets a check.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Almost every year.
He was still alive when we were doing Ghost Rider, I remember.
Yes.
And yet you talked, and I remember he was...
Was it Ghost Rider? No, he passed away on Speed Racer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He was 90 and a half.
Wow. Okay.
And he said, told Kevin's mom not to worry about Kevin because when he gets to Art Center, he's going to meet a nice girl.
Really? Right.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Someone with like interests.
Yeah. And your mom, the story you were telling us is your mom was Tinkerbell, right?
Yeah, she was the original model for Tinkerbell.
Right. So
I had an image for the talk, but I couldn't find it in time.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So you guys both went to Art Center. Obviously, you guys met there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you did a lot of stuff together. You get groups together, do art projects together. You did a band together.
Yeah. Well, we... we were, young.
Yeah.
So at Art Center, we had a handful of friends, and we liked to get together and make art and party and go do stuff and go on adventures and whatnot.
We got a video camera really early on, and we shot a bunch of experimental video, just, experimental music, experimental art.
Yeah.
Always trying to just find something different with our art skills and our art friends.
Yeah, we would. I think that was sort of the beginning of the relationship with technology in a sense, because there weren't computers yet, but there were, reel to reel tape recorders and echo boxes and amplifiers and so we started making music and it became kind of a thing. Our friends were kind of artists and into music as well, and so we'd get together and party, but rather than just party, we would party and record, and we would make music. We'd play music and
record. We had the Moog set up. A friend had the
synthesizers, I think the idea for some of us was that we weren't really into pop music. We weren't interested in being rock stars really. We wanted to make music. We kind of wanted to make films, experimental films, and be able to do the music ourselves.
Right.
And but we sort of got into playing songs and it was all kind of improvised punk, jazz, psychedelic. It was its own thing. We didn't know any covers.
We can write songs.
I'd never learned anybody else's songs. We just wrote them. We just made them up.
You made them up and you basically put on performances.
Fearless.
Yeah. And we played clubs and we did the whole thing.
Yeah.
It was quite an adventure.
Yeah, that's pretty great. Now, you had mentioned that you both continue to pursue your passion for fine arts in a lot of ways. Like, just, you never let it go.
We never stopped.
Never let it
was
go.
It's been the central to our lives all along.
Right. And so, the inspiration that you were doing, like you mentioned the fact that you continue to try to find a way, you eventually got into visual effects and you started working that field because it made sense. You had to get some work, you had to do this, and you didn't do it out of that. It's not support of family, but you didn't necessarily do it out of inspiration. The way that I saw it, or like desperation, is not like, well, I need to get a real job. It never sounded like that at all. You found a way to go, well, I got a job and I started painting and sculpting and doing the things you like to do. It's just not always your original ideas, but you like to do fun things.
Yeah, it was kind of a weird thing for me because I, I grew up in the industry.
Right.
And I was a child actor, so I'd grown up on sound stages, and my dad had me working on backgrounds for commercials he was doing and stuff when I was just a little kid.
Right.
So, and then, by the time I could drive, he had me working as a runner and picking up the film and dropping off the film and, all that stuff. So I had always kind of worked a little bit in a way. I always remember working. And yet when it came to, I always just wanted to make my art. And in fact, I was quite ambitious early in, I had an ambition when I was very young to do visual effects for movies and to make movies. But as I learned what that meant, that it was sort of like, oh, no, that's, it changed. It was like, I don't think I want to do that because I want to make my own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I was already, I was just looking to make money so we could survive and feed our kids. And I did a lot of work for my dad.
Sure.
And I think there was
he bailed us out a couple times.
Yeah. And of course they would help us when I didn't have work or whatever.
Right.
And it was hard for me to really pursue it with the passion that a lot of people do because it wasn't, I realized it wasn't what I wanted in, right. in a sense. But when the computer came along, it was suddenly far more interesting to me because I sort of, you know, I did the scenic painting. It was pretty fun and I liked matte painting, but a lot of the work, most of the jobs I had were pretty labor intensive. And yeah. It's like, I didn't like the shop atmosphere with all the saws and the dust and the chemicals.
It's so physical.
It was just like, this is not for me. And so the computer was just a dream come true to me. I can wear clean clothes and I won't be, you know, picking stuff out from under my fingernails all
fumes,
night.
No fumes.
No yeah. fumes. And it was just.
Gray Marshall told me stories about you painting galaxies.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
It's like you drawing with a big mask and the fumes.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. Oh, I still feel like I have permanent creases on my face from wearing a respirator.
But, right.
It was. I almost wanted to redo my talk or make the theme of it, you know, the reluctant visual effects supervisor, mm-hmm. because I didn't want to do it. And then even when I got into the digital, I was very excited about that, but it was always like, I just want to get access to these tools mm-hmm. and to, you know, and be able to learn to do it for my art.
Right.
And that, you know, I always dream, it's like, we'll figure out a way. We're going to find a way out of this. We're going to be rock stars, or we're going to be fine artists, or we'll find a way. And, but it, you know, with two kids and, you know, the reality of survival is, you know, was, there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I found that there's a theme that runs through my whole career in a sense, which is that on a lot of jobs, man, they dragged me kicking and screaming. I didn't want to do it. And mm-hmm. I was, you know, kind of mad, like, why do I have to do this stuff? And,
mm-hmm.
and inevitably I would have the most amazing adventures, and I would, and by the time, as soon as they'd put a real problem in front of me, a visual problem, I was completely engaged. I didn't mind that. I liked doing that. Or if I had to do a matte painting, it's like, sit at a computer and do a matte painting. I don't care what it's of. Yeah, that's fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time I started at DD, I was way into it.
Yeah.
And then when I had success, it was kind of like, well, is this what I'm supposed to do? You know?
It's hard to say. Just,
yeah.
Yeah. Because you can't just take all that success. That's not really what I want to do.
Yeah, exactly. And my dad would always try to tell me, it's like, you're spoiled. You think you get to pick what you want to do? It's right. like, no, you follow the, what, you know, the opportunities that come your way. That's what you'll wind up doing.
And right.
So I always kind of acknowledged that. But at the same time, I couldn't let go of the fact that I'd had visions since I was a little kid.
Right.
And voices in my head telling me, you need to do this.
Right.
And so I kept doing it at whatever it took. Mm-hmm. I would stay up all night or do whatever I had to do. And there were periods during the digital domain time where, you know, I didn't get to work as much as I wanted to,
mm-hmm.
but, and I threw that on my art, and I learned through that, that, I had to do it. Okay. That if I didn't do it, if I wasn't working on my fine art
mm-hmm.
or projects of my own in some way, I would get sick.
Really?
I would become mentally ill, physically ill. Like I didn't care. I lost all, life lost all meaning for me without it. And so it became just a survival strategy in terms of getting through jobs. It's like, okay, well, I know it's late and I already worked 14 hours today, but I'm going to go home and I'm going to make something. I'm going to work on my, whatever it was I was working on.
Right.
Even if it was only for an hour, you know, I would do something and it would get me through.
You know, it's interesting to say that because I heard you talking to someone outside
mm-hmm.
and you were saying, finding a time to do your art, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is a difficult thing. Everyone has an ambition. I'm going to make my movie or whatever it is, mm-hmm. you know, short, et cetera, et cetera.
And then you got to pay the bills.
But you're going to do it, so you everyone assumes you'll do it when you get home from work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily the best time to do things. And we've had podcasts with other artists that come on and they do their personal work and they say, I found out that if I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and I work for about 3 hours in the morning, I am way more productive than anything mm-hmm. else.
Right. I think that depends on your neurology.
Depends on your neurology, it's yeah. true, because I think that I would be better at it. Personally, myself, mm-hmm. there was a time in architecture school when I was doing my thesis in architecture school, and you're pretty much in studio. You're not really taking any classes. You're in studio 18 hours a day, right? And I found that it was so distracting during the evening when everyone's kind of like going, oh, I'm losing my sleep, I can't be productive, and that's the time when you need to work the most. So what I did is I went to sleep at 6 p.m. and woke up at midnight.
Oh, wow.
So I would get myself a good 6 hours sleep, and then I'd be in studio at 1 a.m., and people were just like, oh, I can't take anymore, I'm leaving. And then I had the whole place to myself and a fresh mind.
Perfect.
Right. And it makes so much more sense. But you said you do that too. You do art in the morning sometimes, don't you?
I was talking to someone who said they have little kids that come and wake him up at 6 a.m. Uh-huh. and take his phone and start doing paintings. I'm like, well, you get up at 5:30 and start doing your paintings, and then when they come in, then you're ready to hand it off.
Right.
And I said, well, he's like, well, so you did that when your kids were little? And I'm like, no.
No, you didn't.
No, I would stay up late.
You'd stay up late?
Yeah.
So you're both able to stay up late and do your work? You're able to keep that fresh mind of what's in there? I guess you never lose it.
Yeah.
When I was younger, just when my eyes were better, now I really need the daylight because I paint on canvas.
Right.
So I really have to have that. I love the daylight for painting on canvas.
Of course.
If it's digital work, then yeah, you can do that. You know, whenever.
And finding your space. That's the other thing you mentioned. Like, you need to have your space, your art space,
if you
right?
keep a space set up for yourself to work, then you know mentally you're set. If it's like you get time, no matter if you're a day person, night person, or whenever, you know it's like, okay, I have this time. I'm going to go to my space and work. Right. And maybe your space is just flipping over your iPad and saying, okay, I'm in my space.
Right.
But you really have to set yourself up knowing that you have that space for creating.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of like make your zone.
And where is your space, Kevin?
Well, it depends on where I'm at and what I'm, you know, if I'm on a project, I might be in another country living in a little hotel room. But,
right. So your space is mobile in a sense, right?
Yeah, it has been. Right now it's not. I'm at home. I work at home. I have a nice little studio in my house.
That's great.
Because our kids moved out and he has a nice room.
So it's awesome. It's the perfect setup. But I think... For me, it's more than the physical space.
Okay.
It's the mental space.
Yeah. Okay.
And I don't know if it's discipline. I mean, I my understanding is that there is a neurological difference between, you know, night owls and morning people.
Right.
And I've found all my life that I you know, if I'm up, I'm good. It's fine. But I just have two things, which is one, if I'm sleeping, I don't want to get up.
Okay.
And if I'm awake, I don't want to go to bed.
Right.
So it's easier for me to just stay up.
Okay.
And I have to be careful because, you know, after a couple of days of that, there will be a cost. If you have to get up at the crack of dawn for work, I'll be a zombie at work. So I have to be careful of that. But I do find that at night, even when I don't have anything scheduled or anything else I have to do, if I work, I can work in the day and it's fine. I can do certain things. But I find that as night comes, my thoughts are clearer. And I swear it's almost like the middle of the night is the best time for me.
Interesting.
Because it's sort of like there's nothing that can interrupt me now. And even psychically, I feel like the brain waves of the area around me, everybody else is sleeping. Uh-huh. And I have better bandwidth or something.
Okay.
I don't know. I know that sounds crazy, but it just, I've fought it. I've tried to do the other thing. And I just find no matter what I do, I am more creative, more inspired, and more productive at night.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool. And like you said, I think everyone's a little bit different, but I think everyone needs to find their time and their space. And that's the thing that I think people struggle with. I just feel sorry for the people that are trying to do something and they haven't figured that time and space that they need to make their thing, you know?
Yeah, it's a big obstacle. And I know there have been times in my life where it was a problem. You know, we had kids. We didn't have room. I didn't have room to have my own space.
And it's depressing.
And yeah, it's really hard. And that was one of the, you know, another great thing about working in the industry is I had access to computers and software and at DD we often stayed late at working anyway.
Right.
And so And they, as a visual effects supervisor, there was a huge advantage because you're sitting around waiting half the time anyway.
Right.
And if I could have my laptop there, or if I could use the computer at work, that was sketchy. You had to be careful of that. Mm-hmm. I would just figure out where I could work, wherever I was.
That's really
find a way. And sometimes I would adapt what I was doing. If I couldn't do 3D, I would paint.
Right.
If I couldn't paint, I would draw in my sketchbook.
Or play music.
I'd take a guitar everywhere I went. Yes. I've been playing guitar my whole life.
And you would often come and serenade me while we were doing walkthroughs.
Yes.
So yeah, it was a really wonderful experience. So. I loved that part of Ghost Rider. The other thing I really appreciate about you as a supervisor, and you made a point of doing this to such an extent that it felt really great, is you always said thank you to everyone who came by and presented a shot. You always said thank you, even if you ripped their shot apart.
Wow.
You basically said, nice. Thank you so much for this effort. I can't wait to see the next one. You know, and so it was always a wonderful thing that you always did. And it's a rare trait, I got to tell you.
Well, I have my father to thank for that.
Yeah.
Growing up, I was always making art, and he was an artist, and he was my greatest mentor. Mm-hmm. And he had a way that was fundamentally different, I noticed, growing up, as I then got teachers. And even my mother would try to help me. She was very helpful and so on. But the manner in which she delivered criticism, or other people delivered criticism, was fundamentally different than the way my dad did. Mm-hmm. And it was the funniest thing, because he had a way of infusing criticism with enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And he would come, I'd be making a drawing, and he'd go, hey, that's great. And then he'd say, you know what, if you do this, see, this muscle goes in front of that one. Mm-hmm. And if you put this line behind there, it's more like what it really looks like. And he would share knowledge with me that was ultimately criticism.
But without telling me what was wrong.
It wasn't a criticism. It was just, he's just sharing knowledge with me.
Right.
He's giving me a tip, you know.
Right.
He's sharing with me some amazing knowledge.
Right.
And so it never felt like criticism. I never considered that. I was like, oh, wow, cool. And I realized over the years, it's like, wow, he was, you know, sometimes he's tearing apart what I did.
Right.
But it wasn't that. He never referred to it that way. It was always just like, oh, what if you tried this? What if you did this? And that's, you know, something I realized, like, wow, that works. I've got to do that.
Right.
Because it was never my intention to be a supervisor. I'm a shy person. I never sought out to be in charge of anyone. It always made me uncomfortable.
Sure.
But I realized, well, if I got to do this, I have to find a way to do it in a way that doesn't make me feel uncomfortable.
Right.
And that was how I did it.
That's interesting, because, you know, I did a podcast with Alex Alvarez, and I don't know specifically which order I'm going to be releasing these, so hope there's a spoiler alert if it's out earlier. Mm-hmm. But Alex's background was complete opposite. And he mentioned the fact that, and this is related to both of you, that the people that seem to be doing great and being supported at their art are the only, every time it's because their parents were artists. He never got support from his parents.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, his entire reason for starting Gnomon and all of the stuff that he's done is directly as a reaction towards his lack of ability to get in, to do what he wanted artistically speaking, and have the education that he wanted. He wanted to be an artist since he was 10 years old.
Keeping going.
Well, he went, you know, got into University of Pennsylvania. They were going to try to force him to be a doctor or lawyer or whatever it was, and he had a hard time. So, but yeah, so having parents that are artists, and this is something that I wanted to, because my wife and I are both artists as well. She's a flame artist, and she's always been a very talented artist. My mother was very artistic as well, and she was an artist, and so she encouraged my art. And also when I wanted to go to architecture school and all of that kind of worked. But I need to make sure that I do the same thing. I need to make sure I encourage art in my kids, which I do, but I don't think I'm giving them enough opportunity, because I think I'm just sort of trying to make it happen naturally on their own, which is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to give them enough opportunity to be inspired by it. So
do they want to do it?
I think so. They like art.
How old are they?
9 and 5 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So we have all these this Go Fish set. Mm-hmm. It's got all these famous paintings on it, Paul mm-hmm. Klee, and you know mm-hmm. all these. But they're all sort of more contemporary art or modern art. But I made my daughter. This is something for people in LA. If you have kids under the age of 18, you can go to LACMA and you can get a pass. If you show them that you live in Los Angeles, you can get a pass to free for your kid to go to LACMA and bring one adult with them up till the age of 18.
How cool. I never heard that.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And they call it Next Kids or something like that. Right?
Oh, I love it.
So went to LACMA and she brought her playing cards. And she's running around the gallery trying to find the artists that are represented in her mm-hmm. card. And she found them. Like, she knew it wasn't exactly that art. She wasn't the same one on her card, but she knew it was the same kind of art. So she was recognized. Like, I found one. It's mm-hmm. like, oh, my God.
You know? So cool.
Yeah. So it was really cool to see that. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, that's good. And I remember my mother taking to museums as a kid, and I enjoyed it. Yeah. But so I did have a point. Hold on a second.
Well, you know, some kids are just gravitated towards it. Like our son, our younger son, was playing. We had one of those little synthesizers that you could sample your voice. When he was like 2 years old, uh-huh. he was playing that synthesizer.
Right.
Yeah, so and singing.
Was it one of those Casio ones?
It was a Casio one. You could sample.
And we had an old. I had an old guitar, just a beater, you know. Uh-huh. And he would pick up that guitar, and he didn't know how to play at all. He's like 3 years old.
Yeah.
3 years old, and he would. He would, his eyes would roll back, and he would rock, and he'd just beat on this thing, and he would improvise songs, melodies, without the words don't even, they weren't even recognizable words,
right.
And yet the melody was clearly a melody.
Right.
So he knew he wanted to take lessons.
He'd be like in ecstasy, like going, ah, da, 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 like, right. And it was like, whoa, okay. Like
I don't know if you can force it. Like our other son, our older son, he's totally science.
Okay.
So science camp, summer, and our younger
kind of a
son
dual
is like music.
Like
so
yeah. And, well, he's an artist as well. He studied sculpture and
but
photography.
But you're a science person too.
Yeah.
You're very much a science person. That's the thing that I always loved about you, because you always come off as like this very wonderful hippie loving guy, and then you just knock us down with some hardcore science, and it just
he's studying all the time.
I know, but it just like mm-hmm. hate you for just being so logical and free spirited at the same time.
They're the same thing to me. It's interesting because there's that quote from Einstein that mystery is what is it. I forget now, but it's something about mystery and is the source of beauty in art and science, in all true art and science.
Right.
And it's like, it was interesting, like art and science. Oh, cool. Like they're the same. He saw them as the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
I told this before, but I'm going to tell you guys because I think it's pertinent. But I was a math and art major in college, so I double majored. Okay.
Wow.
I found math to be beautiful and creative, mm-hmm. especially mm-hmm. the way that you prove a problem. There, you have a hypothesis. You have a problem and a hypothesis, and you're trying to prove your hypothesis based on the problem.
Yeah.
And there's many different paths. And there's an ugly road, and there's mm-hmm. a pretty road.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
if you can show the
elegance.
Pretty road, elegance is beautiful.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I just used to, when you look at a problem and you show it to your, in a test, and you go, wow, cool, that's art, or that's
right.
beauty, And beauty, all beauty is artistic.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that's an area where the public education system failed me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I love math. And I love science, but in school, elementary school and junior high school and high school, I think I had teachers that didn't care. It was boring to me. I saw no application for it in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And there were cases where I even had a teacher I liked. I could not stay awake. I just couldn't. And it was partly because of the the 71 quake, we were on a split schedule, and I had algebra at 7 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a night person, and yeah. I loved this guy, but he put me right to sleep. And it was a kind of a thing. It was a telling thing. I failed algebra.
Yeah.
And I loved the teacher. I loved the thing. And my dad kind of recognized it and solved it. And so he made me go to bed early. It was embarrassing because I was in, that was high school. In right. high school, I had to go to bed at like 8:30.
Oh,
and it was just like, oh sucks. Man, you know?
Right.
But I passed the class, okay. you know, I brought the, you know, brought it up to a C or whatever right. by the end of the thing. And I liked geometry. I seemed to enjoy geometry, but it wasn't until I got into computer graphics and I realized, oh my God, I need to know this stuff.
Right. Yeah, yep.
And all of a sudden I needed to learn it.
But
and,
you absorbed it pretty quickly.
Yeah, but I had, you know, people that really understood it to teach me, mm-hmm. you know, on my terms. It was such a benefit to be there at DD with all these brilliant programmers and mathematicians and artists mm-hmm. That, you know, knew about math.
Right.
And, you know, and it just, it was hard, but, and there are still huge gaps in my math education, sure. I'm sure. But
I forgot most of mine, to be honest.
Well, I forget what I don't use.
Right.
But there are certain things, and it's a weird thing because I realized something about myself recently that I'd always tried to figure, well, what is my thing? Like, what? I always felt like I had some ability that I couldn't express or that wasn't in the vocabulary of our language, and it crossed over different categories and barriers, and I couldn't describe it. I didn't know what it was. I couldn't even recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that there were certain things I could do without knowing anything about them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of like math was like that for me. I realized that working with these guys that knew math, that I had figured out math for right. a lot of the stuff without knowing what I was doing. And I realized that it's a visualization thing or a conceptualization mm-hmm. ability that I have a thing with systems. If I can get a handful of parameters, it doesn't matter what system it is. I can form a model in my head and I can see it and I can extrapolate other parameters and other patterns and functions and things. And that's really handy for solving problems.
Yes, it is.
And when it came to doing, you know, forced perspective miniatures and stuff, like they'd always get me to figure out, well, how much do we, you know, how big is each telephone pole as we go back in scale? And if the whole set's this big, how tall are the trees in the background mm-hmm. versus the foreground and that stuff? And I know that that's trivial stuff, but a lot of folks that they have to either know the math or it's kind of like, oh, I don't know what to do. And I didn't know the math, but yeah. that seemed easy to me. Like I could work it out. And it was scary sometimes because I'd be kind of in a corner where I had to solve a problem like that. And I knew that I didn't know how. But I could just think about the problem and it would become clear. And there would usually be a little bit of arithmetic,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't, I'd always be able to solve it.
If you took abstract algebra today, which is one of the hardest parts of my math background, you probably would ace it without having to worry about it because you basically have to throw away everything about that you know of math.
Mm-hmm.
And you're given all these other conditions that you can do and you have to reform new mathematical systems.
Right.
They're completely and abstract in the true sense of abstract, meaning what is a number? Well, let's define these sets of numbers for this mathematical system. Now you have to completely throw away all of that, you know, and just yeah. start with that. And the same thing with non-Euclidean geometry was, that blew my mind. To be honest, I did a lot of there's hardcore math, right? So you calculus and stuff, and it's like, ugh.
Yeah, I never took calculus.
It's hard. It's hard. It's hard. It's hard. But every now and then I get inspired by the cool definitions and cool proofs.
Mm-hmm.
But then suddenly I got introduced to non-Euclidean geometry and topology and abstract algebra, and I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was like a drug to me. It was beautiful. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was really, really cool. And I would, same thing that you just described, I would go to sleep thinking of n-dimensional spaces. Like, how do I actually visualize?
Me too. N-dimensional spaces. That was like when I first learned what they even were was at DD when Caleb Howard and I were developing the procedural anatomy system.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't have, shape blending yet or anything.
Right.
We had to come up with that. And so we figured out that if we wanted the muscles to change shape and everything, we built an n-dimensional neural network that would blend the shapes.
Wow.
I would go in and hand model it at different poses, and it would interpolate, and I would just be able to move it. And as soon as it broke or didn't look right, I'd just go in and hand model that.
Right.
And it was n-dimensional blending. It wasn't blending from A to B to C to D. It would blend from 5 different or 10 different or 100 different separate vectors.
Right.
And it was the weirdest thing because I didn't know anything about that. But when Caleb would explain it to me, it would be like, oh, I see that.
Yeah.
I can see that. I see how that works. It's a radial neural network.
I did that in I did a 4-dimensional perspective system that I developed on the next machine using Mathematica. That was what got me into visualization. That's what got me into computer graphics.
Wow.
So it was just being able to see something that normal you can't see. And I gotta see it.
Yeah, exactly.
So so you're at school, you're at DD, and you mentioned how you try to take a little bit of your day job and turn it, whatever you could, use that you learned and put that into your art and vice versa.
Yeah.
That's something that I think is important because people get frustrated. It's like, ugh, work. And then they're just like, I can't wait to go home and do my art. Now, you have to be able to be inspired a little bit by both to sort of foster that back and forth.
And that's a hard challenge because we were very fortunate in that we were at the beginning of the digital revolution. We were pioneering the technology, and that makes it fun and exciting. Even if it's a job and it's work and you have to do stuff you don't want to do, at least you're involved in something new and exciting.
Yeah,
and I think that so many jobs, and especially now, a lot of it's not that new. They're not trying to do something new. Mm-hmm. There are ones. There are certainly gigs where it's new and you're developing something exciting,
mm-hmm.
but it's become more about the 9-to-5 in a way. And it's like, okay, here's how we do things. These are the steps. Now do this and put this widget here and
something new.
And mm-hmm. so they just go by the book. And I think that really was. I mean, that was always the hardest thing for me. And even just looking forward, if I was on a thing where, the few times, like when I cleaned aquariums, it was like by the first day I realized, oh, this job is going to be the same day after day, year after year. I'm not well suited for this.
Right.
And I think there's that hunger for new.
Mm-hmm.
For novelty, for something stimulating, without
input,
new challenges. I become dysfunctional.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think it's important to sort of always find a little bit of joy in your work.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I quit, by the way. But because I the minute something is not fun anymore.
Yeah.
It's not worth it to me. I mean, we're only on this planet for a certain amount of time. We have to have fun every day. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I quit too.
Yeah, I know.
It was like, I took the job on the understanding that, they would never make me do a bad movie.
Right.
And then they really wanted me to do Cats and Dogs 3. And I didn't, it was just not my bag. I won't judge the movie or anything. I felt like I can't do this job because... Mm-hmm. it's I don't get it. This is not my. I don't understand the humor or the fun of it. I don't. I'm sure lots of people like it and kids might like it.
Sure.
But for me, it's like if I'm going to be looking at images all day and judging them on their quality and if they work and everything, I don't know how to judge this because it's bad from concept,
right.
as far as I'm concerned. So
yep.
It's like I can't relate.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I bailed and.
But you started, because I want to make sure we have time to cover this. So you'd always had a passion for VR. Like you, before you even knew what VR was.
There was even a word for it, yeah. Right.
And you saw little steps of this technology that was happening, right,
mm-hmm.
along the way. So you say, I remember back in college for me, so let's say it was probably about 92 or something, they mm-hmm. had some guy come in with a VR headset for some game, you know, like you're sitting on this platform with this giant, mm-hmm. huge helmet on your head. And
yeah.
you're right. You described it as looking through a pair of crappy binoculars.
Yeah, or looking down a long tunnel to a little window.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was just, and it was bad resolution and
yeah.
the latency was bad.
Right.
And it all changed. But So what was your interest in VR? Why did you want to make VR?
Well, I didn't know about VR. It wasn't a concept I was familiar with, but I loved 3D
mm-hmm.
Long before 3D movies or anything, except for the ones from the 50s.
Well, I mean stereo.
Stereo,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So as a kid, I loved stereo, and when I was a pretty little kid, I was really into comic books. And a buddy of my dad's was a famous cartoonist, and he had a comic book collection, and he gave me a bunch of his comics, which were, you know, really old 40s, 50s comics.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was a Three Stooges comic book, and it was in 3D. And it came with glasses, and, you know, it was blue and green or mm-hmm. whatever, or blue and red. And I couldn't believe it. The pictures came off the page, and it was like, and I learned how, I got a blue and green pencil and I started drawing. I figured out how it worked and
mm-hmm.
and was making 3D drawings. And, you know, going back even further, this is a story from my very early childhood, mm-hmm. one of my earliest memories. I was probably 2.5 or 3 years old.
Okay.
And I was in daycare or nursery school as they called it then.
Mm-hmm.
And, my mom was late to pick me up, and I was there alone with the teacher or whatever, and she left me to play with some toys, and I found a ViewMaster. I'll never forget it, a bright red ViewMaster,
mm-hmm.
and I started, it freaked me out. I was 3 years old, and I'm looking at, you know, I don't know, Pinocchio and dinosaurs or whatever they had, and they were little, you know, they were dioramas they'd photographed in
mm-hmm.
stereo, and it was so compelling to me that when my mom came to pick me up, she's like, okay, you know, put the toy back. We're leaving now. And I remember thinking, even as a 2.5, 3-year-old, whatever,
right.
I was like, I will fight you one at a time or both together, but this is mine now.
Right.
And I will die before I will give it up.
Right.
And I think something, I don't know, I don't remember crying or anything.
Right.
I just remember, I just looked at them or something with an intensity, and the teacher was like, it's okay, he can take it. It's okay, let him have it. And I got to take that home.
Okay.
And it had a profound effect on my life.
Well, that totally makes sense. Yeah.
So there was that, but then there was also, you know, I grew up in a Disney family, so we went to Disneyland, and
oh, right.
I loved the rides and the one where you ride in and you're inside you become smaller and smaller, and
mm-hmm.
you're inside these immersive spaces that are animated, and a lot of it was just models and projections and stuff,
mm-hmm.
but I loved that.
Right.
And then there was they used to have a big theater that was in the round where they had projection all the way around you. And,
right.
And I remember thinking, that's cool. And so it was the idea that, like, and then when I first learned stereo and headphones and hearing sounds move in 3D and stuff, I thought, what if you put all that stuff together and you could you could project onto a big bubble helmet or something. And, I wasn't sophisticated enough to know how to do it, but I could see that it could be done.
Right.
And the thought of it was overwhelming to me. It became what I wanted to do. I wanted to make, it's like, then I could show people what it's like to be me.
Right.
And see these visions.
Wow. And when did you, because you've been following the technology for a while, is it possible, right?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the Oculus, well, I'll just call it the Oculus Revolution, because they kind of started the fire in a way, I think, in some way.
Yes.
I remember specifically, it was so incredible when I saw it on, I followed The Verge as a website, it's a technology website. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And when they go to CES, they do their daily show. Like, it's literally just they're Verge casting, like, all the time. And mm-hmm. That's what they call it. And they said they don't even have a booth. They don't have anything. It's literally just a ski mask with some black tape around it and some screen touch to it, you know.
Right.
And it's all, and that was the Oculus. And it was presented in a hotel room there.
Yeah,
it was
like, I read about it.
And it was like, this is it. This is the future. And they were like, yeah. You think you've seen VR before, but all the problems that you know that you didn't like about them are solved or are going to be solved very quickly.
Greatly reduced.
And so you had been doing your art for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. Your the stills that you've created are beautiful, and the animated ones you've created are also beautiful. You've done a bunch of animated ones as well.
Well, I got into the 3D printing. It's like, okay, I can't do VR. I can bring the stuff into the real world that way.
Yeah, because you knew they had shapes that people needed to be able to see.
Yeah.
Right. They had to have a three-dimensional shape of some kind. And so once you said, oh, now I can be in this world completely.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what happened to you? Is that like basically you're like, I got to be in this world now and do this?
Oh yeah. It culminated in an interesting way. I was involved with a project that wasn't, that was difficult and frustrating. And at the same time, a buddy of mine had a company that had been doing web-based web-based real-time 3D mm-hmm. entertainment, kind mm-hmm. of an underwater simulation, and I was consulting for him, and mm-hmm. I did some artwork for him. Mm-hmm. And I kept bugging him about when I learned about Oculus and stuff, and I was like, hey, what about this stuff? Your thing would be cool in VR. And he's kind of like, I don't know. You know, if people are going to be willing to put a thing on their face, you know. So I was like, oh, man, I really want to do that.
Right.
But pretty quickly, they got on board, and they got involved with Oculus mm-hmm. and Samsung. And next thing I knew, he called me up, and he's like, hey, we're working with Oculus and Samsung, and, you know, things are happening, and we're going to build a platform, a distribution platform for VR content. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to make something, I might be able to, you know, we can probably help you get it on the device and maybe get it on, you know, on the Oculus store or wherever, you know. And of course, the information was very little, and the plans were constantly changing, and so things didn't quite happen the way I expected. Mm-hmm. But I did make, I went ahead and just, I dove in and made a piece. I'd been thinking of it for years, and
right.
I took a couple weeks and took some ideas I'd had and put it together. And then the real trouble was, like, because I'd wanted to do this for a long time. I've wanted to do movies of my artwork and stuff, mm-hmm. but it's always the rendering thing. How do you afford to render?
It's still a problem.
The stuff. It's a big issue. So, but I didn't want to give up. And my friend said he'd help me, that he'd get some help from some vendors or from people. And
right.
and there were people at facilities that wanted to help. They knew mm-hmm. me. They wanted to help, but they were all too, they couldn't do it. They couldn't afford it. Their machines were slammed.
The resolution that you rendered at?
Well, it was supposed to be 4K, mm-hmm. but by the time I got resources, and at that point, I felt there was a time limit because they were going to release the thing. It was going to come out. And of course it still hasn't, mm-hmm. but, so I wound up rendering my first piece at 3K.
Okay.
Stereo.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Eric Hansen and Greg Downing at X-Res.
Yeah.
I ran into Eric at a 3D printer show.
Oh, right.
And we started talking, and he's like, the VR thing's going to be big. And I was like, well, I got this running thing. He's like, I got a little farm. Why don't you come render it at my place?
Oh, that's awesome.
And
I didn't know that.
It was just a windfall. It was just the coolest thing in the world.
Right.
And you know, I paid him a little bit, but, you know, a fraction of what it would have cost. I actually experimented with the Amazon Cloud. And I dropped $1,000 in an evening and had rendered nothing. You know,
right.
It was just not feasible at all.
Mm-hmm.
So that worked out. I did my piece and been demoing it ever since. And now I have a new piece. I managed to get an old contact at Intel who connected me to someone there, and they rendered my new piece. And it took months, mm-hmm. but it's now I have a new piece, and it's at 4K, and I was able to make, you know, improvements. You know, in visual effects, we're used to doing iteration after iteration, doing tests and things and all that. With VR, I didn't have that luxury. My first pass, my first look at the thing, mm-hmm. was the final.
Right.
It had to be the final because I couldn't afford to render it more than once. Well, and I couldn't even, getting it from the rendered stage to be able to view it, there was no way to view it. And it took so much work and was such a science project to figure out how to get it onto the device and get it to play that I couldn't do that over and over. It takes days of, you know, processing and going through stages and testing it and, you know.
Well, so what I want to say about VR, because the thing about, by definition, VR is to take you to a place that you haven't been before.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or that's almost what, or it could be a place that you've been, but what's the point, really?
Yeah, that's my point as well.
So for us to, because a lot of people want to do, you know, storytelling through VR and mm-hmm. games through VR, but I think there's some challenges that are ahead of that.
Oh, yeah.
But to me, architecture seems like the most natural place to do architecture. You're designing a space. Put it in VR so that you can see what it looks like to be in that space.
That's a brilliant application.
It
VR.
Absolutely has to go there.
Yeah.
But you also have a vision of some place that's unusual, very different and abstract. The more abstract, the better in a sense. Why not be able to see what it'd be like to be in a completely abstract space? Because most abstract art is still just a frame,
right?
Frames can be beautiful, like your frames are gorgeous.
Thanks.
But you want to be completely surrounded by it in an environment, right?
Yes, and there's a fundamentally different way in which our brains process input when it's out there on a screen,
right,
and when you're in it.
Right.
And this is what I've learned from my little experience doing this, is that it is a significant thing. It is a big deal that you are able to access people in a way that has never been done before.
Right.
It's like I've been making abstract art for a long time, and people that love abstract art or mm-hmm. love my work, they love it. But there's a whole population of people that they would love to like it. They might like me, but they just don't, they can't get in. It's like they're intimidated by it or something.
Mm-hmm.
And with VR, it's not. That went away.
Okay.
Everyone who sees it, not one person in the over 1,000 people I've demoed to has said, well, what is it? What's it supposed to be?
No, they get it.
They just get it.
Yeah.
And it's completely abstract. And there's no story. There's no game. It's completely passive. But it's psychoactive.
No one's yawning when they're going in there, for sure.
No,
I watched
no.
the long version, too, and I wasn't yawning. So, yeah. It's... it makes total sense. It makes so much sense. It's kind of scary. Recently, I went to San Diego to the GTC conference, which is the GPU technology mm-hmm. conference. And we'll talk more about that later. But when I was there, I'd known that as a distant uncle of mine who I had never met, but I knew of, and I've kind of been in touch when in college. And his name is Rudy Rucker. Do you know who Rudy Rucker is?
Oh, yeah, I know Rudy Rucker. Yes. His books are awesome.
Yeah, so he's my uncle, and I never met him before.
Really?
And wow. He's basically his wife and my mother are kind of like second-degree cousins or something like
wow.
that.
Wow.
And so they live in Los Gatos.
He wrote Post Singular mm-hmm. and software. Hardware and Software yeah. and Wetware. And
yeah. he's also a painter.
Oh, wow.
He's an incredible painter. You'd actually probably really love his art.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And I would love to find a way at some point to get you guys together. Like, because he's incredible. He's such an amazing
His work has had a huge cool. influence on me. It really inspired me.
Well, he's the father of cyberpunk, in a sense,
ways. Yeah. Well, it's weird because I didn't discover his work till really just a few years ago, but it resonated so strongly.
It does, right? That's why I was thinking about that.
Oh my God, I've been thinking about this stuff my whole life. It's
And he was also a computer science professor.
Piezoplastic, like, right. And he has artists in the stories and stuff.
Right.
Yeah, amazing.
So he studied mathematics and stuff, and he was a computer science professor.
Yeah, he's written books on infinity.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was... imagine writing a book on infinity. I gotta find a way to get us together. But everything that you say resonates so strongly with what I'm trying to do, and I've been thinking about it so much in terms of what we're doing in labs that I'm going to really try to make sure that we have to. I'm going to try to see if you'd let me. I would love to be able to help you.
That would be awesome.
Because I think it'd be very important.
Yeah, we're looking to explore. We just want to do this, and yeah. I feel like I've, you know, in a sense, it's been my whole goal all along. But at the same time, it's also kind of a discovery or a thing I stumbled onto.
Right.
And I feel like I have to follow through with this. This is important.
Right.
And because I think what we're doing, I think we can help people.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a potential to not just entertain them, but heal them, make them better.
Yeah.
And really, you know, in effect, help the world.
Yeah. I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you at all. I think it's important. And I think that, the VR, the art community should consider some new mediums. And I think these are some really good ones to experience. And they can travel with you. It's on a phone, for God's sake,
mm-hmm.
you know. And you can take an entire world with you on your phone and escape to this place.
Demoing ShapeSpace
mm-hmm.
For people has been the most satisfying experience of my life. I've as an artist,
mm-hmm.
I've had some incredible good fortune. I won an Oscar. I've been praised for my work and so on. And I've been proud of the work I've done. I've been very satisfied in many cases. But this is a whole different thing. It's changed the way... it's not that it's changed a way. It's given me a door to interact with people. Okay. I tend to be reclusive. I just want to sit in front of my computer or hang out with my wife or my kids. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to going out to gallery openings or to parties and stuff, I just feel weird. My whole life, it's social anxiety, I mm-hmm. suppose. But it isn't even so much that as just sort of some social thing is missing in me. I would stand at parties like, why are we here? What are we doing? What are mm-hmm. we supposed to do? We're just standing here. And I get that that's weird, but it's just sort of a strange thing. And with demoing ShapeSpace, I'm able to interact with people. I have a reason to talk to them
mm-hmm.
and engage them, and it makes me feel comfortable with complete strangers, which is something I've never had. It's amazing, and people just love it. They really love it. I get people just hug me and thank me and cry and tell me, you know, that this fixed their whatever. Like
right.
I've had people tell me it just demolished their anxiety. We've had three people who regained 3D vision, stereoscopic vision, who were monoscopic.
Huh.
And I can't explain that, and that's probably has something more to do with just VR in general, mm-hmm. but still, it's just every time we demo it, there are, you know, new and more exciting reactions.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, I'm not saying this because a lot of people, when they experience VR for the first time, it's always kind of a wonderful thing. But I've experienced a lot of VR. I'm involved in it. I'm writing a white paper on it right now. I'm just like, I know what it's about. And I'm a little bit VR tired, to be honest, in a lot of ways. But that was different, you know, and it was something that never occurred to me. It never occurred to me that is something that could be in the VR space. And I don't know why, because I saw Lawnmower Man. Lawnmower Man was basically showing something similar. It was like crazy abstract spaces in a VR world. But I experienced it, and that became like, oh, well, you know what? If they actually do it this way, you could really feel the euphoria, right? Yeah. There's a euphoric experience when you put that on. You're like, look, and then, you know, and the other thing that I love about it is you're looking here and look there, and then you look to the side, and something's really close to you. And, you know, you jump back a little bit, and you're like, but it's so beautiful. And then you look at it closer, and it's just so.
Well, it's an amazing thing. I initially thought, oh, I'm, you know, I was all excited because people were loving it. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, this is, it's just VR. People have never seen VR before. Then we started demoing for, you know, VR veterans and at VR shows where people have seen it all and the same reaction.
Yeah.
So it's
I think it's very exciting.
It's, I think it makes it VR combined with the stuff makes it possible to alter consciousness in safe, effective and positive ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I really appreciate both of you coming. I'm going to end the podcast, but I want you guys to stick around because I want to show you some stuff.
Okay, cool.
I want to explain some of the things that are going on, and maybe we can help you guys out or whatever we can do, because I think that it's, like I said, it's very exciting. I really appreciate it. All right,
cool.
Thank you guys.
Thank you.